And now, the main event, we will have our main speaker, Ronald White, all the way from Los Angeles. Welcome.
Thank you, Brenda. Good evening. My name is Ronald White, and I'm an alcoholic. Bren, can you tell me what time would you like for me to stop?
Sorry, 45 minutes, Ron, 9:15.
Okay. All right, thank you so much. Again, my name is Ronald White. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank this particular group for inviting me out to share. I know it's Inette's doing that I'm here, and I'm so grateful that she asked me. I'm grateful that I had the opportunity to hear her share. Happy birthday. Very, very significant. Inette is a powerhouse. It's really a joy to sponsor her. She challenges me as a sponsor for me to be on my game. And so I appreciate that. And she is somebody who is totally willing. And that's the most I can ask, is for somebody to be willing. And she's open-minded and she takes suggestions, even if she has to grit her teeth to do so. And I want to wish the other birthday celebrants happy birthday, particularly my friend Sylvia. It's nice to see you, Syl. And I'm just going to talk about the miracle that is Alcoholics Anonymous and the program that literally has given me back my life, in fact, given me a life. And I had some decent things happen to me prior to Alcoholics Anonymous, as you may hear in my story, except that the things that have transpired for me since I've been here are phenomenal. In the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, they tell me that I should share in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And I know it's important, it's vital for me to share what I used to be like, not because we want to glamorize drinking and all the stuff I used to do and I was drinking and using. However, I think it's for the purpose of allowing our new friends, anybody who might be new to Alcoholics Anonymous, identification, that they can know that, you know, even though I might sit here and I should let you know, I may have neglected to tell you my sobriety date. My sobriety date is July the 14th of 1986. And somebody who is new might hear that date and they might think, nah, this dude got 34 years, he's nothing like me. Probably can't understand what I'm going through and what's happening with me right now. And I can't even fathom 34 days, let alone 34 years. And so I know that we share in the general way what we used to be like for the purpose of letting them know you're no different than I was when I first got here. And my first day this time in Alcoholics Anonymous, the beginning of this 34 years was a Monday morning, July the 14th, 1986, when I was standing in the lobby of a place called the Harbor Light Center, a place run by the Salvation Army located on what we in Los Angeles call the Nickel. That's Fifth Street, Skid Row, downtown Los Angeles. Salvation Army Harbor Light Center is an all-men's alcoholic recovery facility that housed 150 beds for alcoholic men. I was being interviewed, and I'm not talking about no job interview, y'all. I was being interviewed to see if they would give me one of those beds. And as the guy who was interviewing me was asking me those intake questions, I remember as he asked me the questions, I mumbled my answers as I stared at these beat up tennis shoes I'm wearing, because I'm staring at the shoes because I don't even want to look this guy in the eye. I'm so ashamed of being there. And as he continued to ask me questions, I looked at these filthy clothes that I'm wearing. And I'm looking at this gray, this black overcoat I'm wearing because I didn't want you to see how malnourished I had become. It's the middle of July and a heat wave, and I wear an overcoat everywhere I go because I didn't want you to see what a skeleton I had turned into. I smelled so badly, I don't even see how the guy could stay in the same room as me because I had stopped bathing. I'm filthy. The stench that the alcoholic has on them, you know, I had it on me. And I felt hopeless and I felt helpless because I'd never had any dreams nor aspirations at age 31, standing up in the Harbor Light Center begging them for a bed. And it wasn't one of the top 10 goals in my life to become a drunk. In fact, quite the opposite. I thought because my dad drank. My dad was an alcoholic. He was a wino. That's what we called it back in the day. I'm 65 years old. I was born in 1954. And the beverage my dad liked to drink when I was young was something called Ripple, cheap wine. I grew up in South Central Los Angeles, in Watts on 108th and Central. It's right in the middle of the city of Watts. Watts is just in the city of Los Angeles. And I have five brothers, six boys in my family. There happened to be four of us sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. My brother Ralph, my brother Reggie, and my baby brother Rod are all members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And even though back then you never would have seen us coming, because we were nerds, you know, we didn't drink because my mom didn't allow drinking after she put that father of mine out when I was about 8 or 9 years old because of his drunkenness, because of his being irresponsible and not being able to carry his load. And so she wanted to make sure we were nothing like him. And I didn't want to be like him. You know, I wanted to make my mother proud. I didn't want to make my mother cry like he did. And so me and my brother Ralph and my brother Reggie all immersed ourselves into books. And I know, looking back and seeing, I know this process of recovery is often understood best by looking back. And I look back on why I like to escape so much. And I know and I realized that at the time, I felt what the doctor describes in our big book, in the doctor's opinion, where he describes alcoholics. And he says that one of the things that he said about them that was unique is the fact that they seem to have this allergic reaction to alcohol, that they craved alcohol when they drank it. But that didn't really catch me when I first read the doctor's opinion, because I told y'all I didn't drink for the first part of my, in fact, I didn't drink until I was 18 years old. But even while growing up not drinking, I still had what the doctor described as, I call it the ism of alcoholism. He said these alcoholic men and women, when not drinking, seem to suffer from feelings of being irritable, restless, and discontented. And it's so funny because I heard Inette share about coming from that that Donna Reed kind of home, that home that I would look at, because that was another one of my escapes, television. And I would look at Leave It to Beaver and Donna Reed and Father Knows Best. And, you know, I would look at those households and sounds like Inette came from one of those. And she was just the opposite. And I kind of got a little salty when she was sharing for a minute, because she said, you know, I thought alcoholics had to come from broken homes and impoverished background. I was saying, well, hey, that's me. that's me. except it's funny how both she and I are here. So I guess where you grow up or how you grow up doesn't make you an alcoholic. What makes me an alcoholic is the fact that I do have an allergic reaction to alcohol, that once I did start to drink, I did develop the craving that's associated with alcoholism. I was unable to control the amounts that I took, but I'm getting ahead of myself, because even while I was growing up, I had this other thing, this irritability, restlessness, and discontentment. It showed up in me being so insecure about my height, about my complexion, my color. And I don't mean being black, but damn it, so black. Seemed like even black people discriminated against me, you know. And I just wanted to be high yellow. I never, you know, with good hair. And as I came up, man, I hated the way that I looked. I hated my condition of not having a dad in the home. I hated the way that my mother had to cook and clean for other people's families and iron clothes. And she had a rag on her head and she didn't look glamorous like those people I saw on television. And I, you know, man, it's shit. I needed a drink when I grew up to help me escape from the prison of my thinking, but I couldn't drink. And so I escaped in those books. I escaped in television. There was actually a television show that I gravitated to that later became one of the guiding forces in my life. This was a show called Perry Mason. Perry Mason was a criminal defense attorney played by an actor named Raymond Burr. And I'm talking about those old black and white series back in the 60s. And Perry was one of the handsomest dudes I saw on television. He had a command and a presence about him. When he would stride around the courtroom, he was always saving his client at the end of the episode, and they looked at him so grateful, and I wanted somebody to look at me like that, with that gratitude, like, you're my hero. He wasn't like one of those heroes in those old comic books I used to watch, and I would run around my neighborhood with a towel around my neck. He was a real man. I could see him on the television, and I thought, maybe I could do that. Maybe I could be Perry Mason. And so I grew up wanting to be a lawyer. As I came through every school that I went to, in elementary school, junior high school, and finally high school, I was a straight A student. I was on the honor roll at every school that I went to. But it's funny, and this kind of like strikes me sometimes when I think about this, and when I heard Inette share about comparing herself to her brother and his successes and always seeming to come short. My brother Ralph was always he's 1 year older than me. Reggie is a year and a half younger than me. So we always kind of stair-stepped coming through school. And Ralph was always in the classroom right ahead of me. They place you in your room by your names, right? And I was always in the homeroom after him or the next. And he always was a high achiever, always got A's. He played sports good. I couldn't play sports. He would always get A's. Whenever I would arrive in the class, they would say, oh, you Ralph White's brother, right? And so even when I got these good grades, I always kind of like would think to myself, is it really me getting this, or am I getting this because I'm Ralph's brother? And I'm like most alcoholics. I don't know about most alcoholics. Let me tell you about me. I've always suffered from this dichotomy of feelings, these competing feelings of feeling less than and also feeling better than. And I always, the pendulum swings oftentimes, and I am buffeted between those two things. And a lot of times, man, internally I feel less than, but externally you'd never know it because I present well, and I will always make you think that I got it together, and I'm better than you, and I know better. But I've always had this inner feeling of feeling somewhat fraudulent, feeling like maybe I don't really deserve this. And I'm a student. I'm at this school called Locke High School in South Central LA. I start playing in the band when I was in junior high. I started playing trombone, and I get to high school and I join Locke's marching band. And we're pretty renowned in South Central Los Angeles. And we won a lot of awards, and we went to the Rose Parade in Pasadena on New Year's Day. And we marched. I marched in the front rank, in the front line of the parade. And we went to Hawaii for the Aloha Parade, and a few of us from that band joined formed a jazz ensemble where we went to the Hollywood Bowl and won sweepstakes in the Battle of the Bands as the top jazz band in the nation. A few of my jazz men, they later became professional musicians, and I always compared myself to them. I was good, but they were better, right? You know, and I was elected my senior class president. I got accepted to go to college on a full academic scholarship at a school called Loyola University. It's now called Loyola Marymount University. It's a private Jesuit Catholic school run by Jesuit priests here in LA, in a suburb of Los Angeles called Westchester. And I'm not a Catholic, I'm a Baptist kid, Southern Baptist, raised in Tabernacle of Faith Missionary Baptist Church. I always went there every Sunday morning with my mother and my brothers. Now, what is a Catholic school doing accepting me on a full scholarship because of my grades? And, you know, it sounds like I was pretty successful as I came through school, that I had some blessings, some things that I could be proud of. But guess what? I'm an alcoholic in waiting. I haven't even taken a drink yet, and yet I have the ism. And the way that shows up for me is this. Anything I've ever achieved doesn't seem to have the same quality as the things you achieve. That the grass always looked greener on the other side. My glass was never half full, it was always half empty. I've always strived to achieve something, and when I get it, it doesn't seem to have the effect I thought it was, or if it did, I get tired of it real fast, and I'm always looking for more. I never wanted to be a bookworm. I wanted to be a quarterback. I wanted to be somebody scoring touchdowns, being written up in the LA Times, got cheerleaders on the sideline cheering for me. Nobody ever came in science class with pom-poms. So I'm like, yes, Ronald, that's the right answer, right? You know, I know that what I've always probably wanted in my head was a lot of applause, a lot of cheering, and people told me I was all right. I'm sure, I'm certain of it. In hindsight, people told me, you're smart, you're this, you're that, but it just didn't seem like it was enough. So I grow up wanting. And when I finally graduated from high school, getting ready to go to college, I went to a beach party to celebrate my graduation, and I saw a guy and a girl underneath a blanket, and the blanket was moving. And I looked, and the girl was giggling. And I thought, I want to get underneath a blanket. But everybody knows I'm the professor, and the professor doesn't get underneath blankets. But somebody was sharing, was passing around something, and I wish I remember what it was, because it became my first drink. It was either some Tyrolia or some Spignata, cheap wine, just like my daddy used to drink. Because you see, by now, my thinking told me, I can take a drink. You won't become your daddy. Your daddy was a high school dropout, so I thought. I've later learned, funny, my dad just died a couple of weeks ago. I've learned that my father wasn't everything that I thought he was when I was young. So, you know, that's, wow. So in any event, I thought I was smarter than him. I thought I was better than him. He was a janitor. I'm going to be a lawyer. So I thought I could drink. And I did. Probably only another alcoholic can truly understand the effect produced in me by alcohol in the beginning, when it was working. Alcohol made me feel taller, made me feel bigger. It made my skin feel lighter. It made my hand go in my pocket, and I kind of got this lean, and I just got cool. And the guy who was a nerd, who was so square, he didn't even know how to curse people out. Y'all have to excuse me. I have to use this one word just to describe the difference alcohol made in me. I would try to curse people out when I was, before I started drinking. And I would say, oh, you motherfucker. Right. People laughed at me. After I started to drink, yeah, motherfucker, it worked. I knew how to curse. I knew how to talk to girls. I could dance better. I could do. Alcohol freed me. It freed me from every fear and inhibition that I had ever grown up with, and it worked. And I had found the thing that I had been seeking. I had become a part of a fellowship of men and women who shared their experience, strength, and drinks with each other. And I had arrived. I was a black kid on the college campus, man, and I would start to drink, man, and I was going to the parties on the weekend. I was going to the beer bus and the panty raids, and I became the president of the Black Students Freedom Alliance. You know, this was back in the 70s, and we were God, it was fun. Wow. It was an amazing, amazing time. And you know, I hear some people share that their worst day, you know, the best day of drinking isn't as good as their worst day in sobriety. And that ain't my story, because I had some great times. Unfortunately, that's what all my head wants to remember, were those good times. And they lasted for a couple of years. But respecting the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't go into detail about all the other things that I did, but you need to know I'm a garbage can. That after a while, just drinking, I needed more. So I started smoking weed, I started doing mushrooms and pills and all the stuff you do in the 70s, right? And after a couple of years of doing it, and no longer just doing it at the parties, because I need to be feeling good on Monday and on Wednesday, now I'm daily drinking. Now my grades start to slip. Now I start to cheat on exams to keep up. Now I start plagiarizing term papers to keep up. I start becoming a liar and a cheat. And my spirit really started getting sick, because I start now crossing every moral line and every value that I had, that I'd grown up with, I start to discard in favor of alcohol. And besides, I'm still passing my class, and I graduate from Loyola University on time in 4 years in 1976. And I happened to get accepted to go to law school, pursuing Perry Mason. I went to a law school in San Francisco called Hastings College of the Law, one of the most prestigious law schools in the nation. And the only reason I went there is because I couldn't go to law school in LA. I got accepted to Loyola Law School, but I knew those long-throated brothers of mine who I was getting loaded with, Ralph and Reggie and my oldest brother, Willie and Rod, and I know they're gonna drag me down if I stay in LA with their drinking. And so I escaped from them to San Francisco. And unfortunately, however, I did take one brother there with me I shouldn't have, me. Because my disease blossomed when I went to law school. And I become a law clerk for a lawyer up there who's an alcoholic just like me. And he taught me how to work hard and how to play hard. We would work all day. And when the clock hit five, man, he would send me across the street to the liquor store to buy a couple of fifths of brandy. And after we downed that brandy, he put some more money in my pocket and we really started the party. And this was a regular thing. And I went to summer school after my first and second year, and I graduated from law school early in 2.5 years, just before my 24th birthday. I'm 23 years old, and I graduate from law school. My fellow classmates were finishing their last semester, and I stayed in San Francisco to study for the bar exam, you know, and I wanted to cross the stage with my classmates when they graduated. And so I take the bar exam, and the results happen to come out on the same day as my graduation. And I learned before I even walk across the stage that I passed the bar. And at age 24, I become one of the youngest Black attorneys ever licensed to practice law in the state of California. And I know I am going to be a millionaire by the time I'm 30. I'm going to be the next Perry Mason. I just know, man, I'm a genius. I'm a boy wonder. I just know, man, I got it made. What I've discovered is the worst thing you can serve an alcoholic is not adversity, it's success. Because that success fueled my ego to the point that I was on a 5-year run where I burned to the ground every blessing, everything that I had been given, to the point that in by 1985, I moved back home with my mother because I can't afford my own house. So I moved back to mama's house. And I happened to be there with my other five brothers who were just like me. And we're all living back at home with my mother. We almost killed her. She had a nervous breakdown, I think, in 1985 because of the stress that we were putting on her. I was stealing food out of her refrigerator to cook plates for people around the neighborhood. I stole shoes out her closet. I stole a gold watch that she had been given by her job. And then, no, man, I love my mother more than life. But there was something about that other thing that the doctor talked about in the doctor's opinion that does become operative for me now. And that is the craving, that allergic reaction to alcohol. That when I take one of anything, I do the abominable. I do the unimaginable. I do the things to my mother that I would kill other people if they did them to her. I'm the wolf in the house. And I'm doing these things to my mother that I never dreamed that I would do. My mother sacrificed everything for me and my brothers. I told you how she cooked and cleaned for other people's family to keep food on our table when she put that drunk out of a father of mine out. That she went to night school to get a high school diploma and later a college degree, while still being the president of the PTA, keeping us in church every Sunday morning. Without a family car, we would be on the bus or in my grandparents' car or somewhere, but she made sure we were spiritually fed. And this is a woman who was damn near a saint, and we're killing her. And I had a major hand in that. And see, and the solution would be simple. It would be, Ronald, if you never took the first one, you'd never have to worry about the craving, but there's something about my thinking that's described in chapter 3 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. the chapter called More About Alcoholism. They need to call it subtitled with the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking. Because every time I said I wasn't going to ever do it again, I would do it again. And my mother, there was one Sunday that I dragged myself home. A guy beat me real bad and I looked bad. My mother almost fainted when she saw me, but she took me. She was the woman who I used to call my chief enabler. She was the person who loved me until I could get here. My mother, she put me in the tub. She cleaned me up and she cooked and she fed me. And then she prayed for me. She prayed with me. And my mama could pray. We were holding hands and we're rocking. And I'm crying and she's crying. And she's saying, God, please help deliver my son from whatever this is that has. And I'm crying. I say, Mama, I'm never going to do this again. And when I say this, y'all, I mean it with everything in me. And I don't get loaded on Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday. And somewhere around Thursday, my head unbitten, nothing in my system just simply says, that ass whooping wasn't that bad. My scars healing up, right? But I don't get loaded, right? But I get paid on Friday. And when I get paid on Friday, I could not recall with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even days ago. I could not even remember praying with my mama. And I'm loaded. That's just one time out of years of those. And until I could address the third part of my illness, I heard Inette share about that. That malady of my spirit, the soul sickness that I suffer from, that sense of, that lost sense of self, that's all it is too. That it's a hole in my soul where I can never get enough to make me feel ease and comfort. And alcohol used to do that. And that obsession lies to me and tells me it will do now what it used to do. On July the 13th of 1986, I burned a guy out of some money and he wanted it back and I didn't have it. And he decided to try to beat it out of me. And he's doing this in my mother's front yard. He's trying to beat me to death. As he's beating me, I felt like I was separated from my body watching it happen. And I see my mother step out on the porch of her house and she's watching this happen. And I expected her to say, stop, stop, that's my baby. But my mother says nothing. And I look back over and the guy's name was Kenny and Kenny was still kicking me and stomping me. And I look back at my mother and my mother turned around and she walked back in the house and she simply closed the door. And I knew at that moment that whatever it was that I had done that had beat the love out of that woman who had loved me unconditionally for all of my life. I was an asthmatic child and I used to have to go to the hospital. This was back before they had inhalers and all that. And I would have to go to Children's Hospital and my mother would sit next to my bed. I would be under these oxygen tents and she would simply put her hand underneath that tent and hold my hand through the night numerous times, man. This is the woman, man, that I knew would always be there for me. When my mother turned around and closed that door, I knew I was done. The next day is when I went to the Harbor Light Center in the state I described to you at the beginning of this meeting, more dead than alive, and they gave me a bed. And I did nothing but eat and sleep for the next 7 days while they detoxed me. And then I started coming to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and listening like only a dying person could hear. There were men and women that can't brought meetings into that recovery home, AA meetings. And there were people sharing with me like I'm sharing with you tonight that I would come and then I would come to. And then I would come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, the spiritual solution to my spiritual problem, step two in the program of recovery. Now, when they told me that I needed to find a higher power, I knew they were talking about God. I had grown up in church. I told y'all my mama kept us in church, but I thought, if that's the solution, it will not work for me because I've gone back to church and tried to stay sober and I always got loaded. God obviously doesn't want to have anything to do with me because of all the, if you had done the things that I had been doing, what God would want to have anything to do with me? And they say, Ronald, we have a chapter for a guy like you. Chapter 4, We Agnostics, the spiritual kindergarten. And it's within the pages of that chapter that I learned how to set aside everything that I thought that I knew about God. about spiritual terms, about spirituality. And in that chapter, there's a line that says, deep inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God, that he has sometimes been obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things. But it tells me that if I am willing to search fearlessly within myself, not without myself, within myself, we believe that it's only there that he can be found. And I got hope, because I've always looked for God in the sky, or in a preacher, or in my mother, and somebody else who's always seemed so much more godly, so much more spiritual than me. And I finally decided to look for God inside, within. I was at the Harbor Light Center for 130 days while they set me on a path of discipline. The recovery home is not Alcoholics Anonymous. However, it is a place where I could stay, where I would be removed from where I got loaded. And they helped me go to meetings. I was taking a van to meetings and then catching the bus to meeting from the recovery home. After 130 days, they sent me to a second phase of their program, a sober living, a place called Harmony Hall. Harmony Hall is where they start to get the guys back into real life, getting us clothing vouchers, getting us, you know, social security guard back, a driver's license, all the stuff that I had lost. I didn't think I could be a lawyer again. I thought that was gone. I had been practicing law illegally without a license, never paid my bar dues, always drank up the money. So when I got sober, I was just going to be satisfied with whatever I could do. I was just great, glad to be sober. The first job they got me through that sober living was a part-time job being a bookkeeper for this little old lady who had a nursing home. That might sound fancy, bookkeeper. Let me tell you what I did. I would catch the bus to this lady's house from the sober living. She would sit me on a chair in her living room, and she would give me a stack of her bills. And she took her checkbook, and she signed a bunch of blank checks. And she said, Mr. White, I want you to pay all my bills, and I want you to balance my checkbook, and I'll be back in a couple of hours. And she left me alone in her house with a bunch of blank signed checks. And I'm 5 months sober, and I'm scared. When she came back a couple of hours later, I was sitting just where she had left me, and I handed her her bills, and they were all sealed up with checks inside. And I gave her her checkbook back, and there were no checks missing, and the checkbook was balanced. And there was nothing missing in her house. She paid me $40 a week to do that job. And when I put that $40 in my pocket and caught the bus back to Harmony Hall, I felt 10 feet tall. Because it had been a long time since anybody had trusted me. And I did not burn them. And I knew there was something about that spirit that had gotten so sick when I started to drink and use was changing. And I grew closer to the power. When I was 10 months sober, they told me I had to leave Harmony Hall. That was the sober living, because they had to make room for somebody else to come over from the Harbor Light Center. I'm hiding out in the sober living, afraid of moving back to my mother's house because that's where I used and drank. And I think I can't do it, man. I want to stay sober more than anything. And I shared this in a meeting that this panel brought into my sober living. And there was this lady named Yvonne who heard me share. She was bringing in the meeting, and she approached me after the meeting. She says, Ron, she said, you can move into my apartment with me and my roommate, Jenny, until you feel comfortable enough to move back to your mother's house. And you know, when she stepped to me, she said, I can move in with her and Jenny. You know what I heard. I want you. With my good 10 months sober self, right? You know how attractive we are at 10 months. Well, when I moved into Yvonne and Jenny's apartment, thank God that I had had some principles through going to those AA meetings. They gave me a key, and I didn't disrespect their house. And I didn't try to make any moves on them, and they didn't try to make any moves on me. And they taught me the meaning of trust and unconditional love. And I grew closer to the power. When I was a year and a half sober, walking around AA meetings, talking about how the program works, keep coming back. And somebody, I think it was my friend, Carl Peterson. Big Carl approached me after one of the meetings and said, Ron, you always walking around how you talking about how you trust in God and the program works. Why don't you call the state bar and find out what's happening with your bar card? Living in fear in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. so afraid of rejection. That's one of my chief activating fears, is rejection. If I think the answer is going to be bad, I won't even ask the question. So instead of me finding out if I can practice, I just disbar myself. So I called up the state bar because of that urging of that member. And they told me, you haven't been disbarred, Mr. White. You've been suspended. Non-payment of dues, $2,500. Pay all your back dues. You can get your bar card back. Well, $2,500 sounded like $25,000. I had a minimum wage job at the time. But you know something? It's amazing how much money you can save when you're not drinking. I saved half of every paycheck for the next 6 months, and I wrote a check for $2,500 to the State Bar of California, and they gave me my bar card back. A couple of months later, somebody else from the fellowship says, Ronald, isn't it time for you to apply for a job as a lawyer? Still living in fear, afraid of sending out that resume, you know, where you got that gap, you know, when you first get sober, when you're not working at your profession or your job or whatever. And I'm wondering, how can I put down Harbor Light, Harmony Hall, bookkeeper? By now I'm a proofreader for a law firm. What law firm is going to want to hire me? They said, Ronald, just trust in God. First job I applied for was with the Los Angeles County Public Defender's Office. They were doing interviews, and I went in for an interview with that raggedy resume. And I thought they weren't going to ask me about it, but at the end of the interview, this smart-ass lawyer says, Mr. White, we've been looking over your resume. Well, you notice we noticed you haven't been practicing law for the last 2 years. Why not? I said, sir, I'm an alcoholic. Didn't plan on telling them that, but y'all got me trained. And I think my name is Ronald White, alcoholic, right? I said, I'm an alcoholic. I said, I've been sober for the last 2 years. They said, Mr. White, lawyers do a lot of drinking. Don't you think the stresses of this position might make you want to drink again? I said, sir, it was stressful when I was out there. I said, I think God has prepared me to do this job. And they looked at me funny. I don't think they hear the G word, job interviews, very much. But, you know, is that a reference, God? Right? They don't know. That's my best reference. They said, we'll let you know in 10 days if you're on the waiting list or if we can hire you. I went home not feeling too confident. Hours later, after I got home, said, we want you in for another interview this Friday. I thought they must want me to take a urinalysis or something, right? When I showed up that Friday, they didn't ask me to pee in a bottle. They had me see the head public defender of all Los Angeles County, a guy named Wilbur Littlefield. Mr. Littlefield set me on a chair in his office, and he started walking around talking about what public defenders do. And I'm sitting fidgeting like a witness in Perry Mason, waiting for him to start asking me questions about alcohol, right? You know, but Mr. Littlefield just stops talking, and he doesn't say anything about alcohol. He just gives me this funny look. And he walked over to the chair where I sat, and he held out his hand to me. And he said, Ron, we'd be proud to have you join our office. I like to remember the way that I felt when he said that. Didn't he know just 2 years before I was sleeping on my mother's floor, stealing the food out her refrigerator? The only job I had was carrying out the trash and watering the lawn for a 21-year-old dope dealer. What is that but a miracle? Alcoholics Anonymous takes broken up pieces of men and women. Working with the guidance of a loving God, we put the pieces back together again. It was as if each man and woman who I see in all of these different squares were standing in the lobby of the Harbor Light Center. When I arrived there, more dead than alive, with my chin on my chest, too ashamed to look you in the face, and you guys walked up to me, and you placed your hand underneath my chin, and you lifted up my head. And even more than that, you wrapped your arms around me, as dirty and as filthy and as nasty as I was. You wrapped your arms around me, and you literally love me back to life. Damn. See, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had untold miracles take place for me since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had three brothers come into the fellowship after me. 29 years ago, I married the mother of my son. Yes, right, a son. My wife gave birth to Ronald Jr. February 1st, 1991. I got married May 8th, of 1991, February 8th of 1991, Ronnie was born. My wife had a six-year-old daughter when we met. I thought that I would never be accepted by her, being stepdad and all this. When she graduated from high school, she introduced me to all of her classmates as her dad. And that beautiful little girl, Terrence, has now given me four wonderful grandchildren. I've worked for the Public Defender's Office in Los Angeles for 12 years. While I was a public defender, I was invited to the White House in Washington, D.C. by Bill Clinton, because they wanted my input on a federal crime bill they were putting together. I'm standing on the lawn of the White House being interviewed by radio stations. Hell, I was watering the lawn for the dope man. I had my own law office for 15 years, representing the children and members of Alcoholics Anonymous and all kinds of other people, being able to have my Perry Mason moments in court. But I need to let you know, man, that Alcoholics Anonymous is not all about peaches and cream and pink clouds and puppy dogs and all that kind of stuff. We have some down times in Alcoholics Anonymous as well. 5 years ago, I found myself sitting in the parking lot of my law office, reading a letter and contemplating suicide. The letter that I was reading said that the state bar intended to disbar me because of my representation of a client who had embezzled $1 million from one of his investors, and because I did not supervise his business activities as I was supposed to when the money came through my trust account, they were going to take my license. And I felt like a failure. And I felt so ashamed. And I didn't want to face anybody. I didn't want to look at my wife and tell her I had lost everything. And my mother, who had been so proud of me for 28 years, I had been sober at that time. How can I come back to you in Alcoholics Anonymous and tell you of all the things that you guys had given me and I had done something like this? And I wanted to kill myself. And I don't know which meeting it was that I might have gone to, which person it was that I might have sponsored, which fifth step it is that I might have heard, which thing it was that I put in the sober bank of my sobriety. In Bill's story, Bill talks about how his friend Ebbie Thatcher had stressed to him the importance of practicing these principles in all our affairs. And Ebbie had told him, for if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through strenuous work and self-sacrifice for others, then he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. And if he did not work, he would drink. And if he would drink, he would die. Then faith would be dead indeed. Thank God that I had been in the middle of the herd in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I had the commitments that I had been working with others. And somehow that got me through that dark period and got me home. And my wife embraced me and said, honey, we're going to be all right. And she started going back to work after having not worked for 25 years. And she carried us for the next 2 years till I could find work. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, when we lost our home, they helped us move to another place. You guys have demonstrated what real love means to me. In the 3 days, 3 or 4 days after I was thinking about killing myself, my brother Ralph and I had to go speak at a convention, the Music City Roundup in Nashville, Tennessee. And I didn't want to go because I knew I would have to talk about what had just happened to me, and I was so ashamed. And I was at breakfast with two members of Alcoholics Anonymous in Tennessee, sharing this with them and crying. Kent Coleman and Steve Lee, they let me use their names for their story. And I'm having breakfast with them, and I'm crying, and I'm saying, I don't know what to do. Who would ever want me to come and share at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous again? They had just been sitting sharing with me things they had gone through, adversities they had in sobriety. And they said, I said, who would ever want me to come share at another AA meeting? I'm a failure. And one of them said, Ronnie, don't you know in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more you fuck up your life, the more we want to hear your story. And they said, not because we want to hear that you messed up. We want to hear, how did you not drink through that? How were you able to make it through losing it all and still stay a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous? It's a power. It's a power greater than myself that has restored me to sanity. I am now working in recovery. My life is better than it's ever been. Right now, I'm on a little, you see little curtains behind me. I'm on a little staycation with my wife. We're in a nice fancy hotel where we just got away for a week just to get away, you know. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys have literally given me everything. That workshop, let me tell you something. I'll leave you with this. In November of 1987, my mother was getting ready to go to church, and she was dressed beautifully in some church clothes, almost the same day she was the day that guy tried to beat me to death in front of her. She walks into the doorway of her living room. She stops and she looks around and she starts to cry. She starts crying because the living room had a bunch of drunks sitting in it. And each one of these drunks were holding a copy of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous in their hand. Because my brother Ralph, our friend who just passed away, Leon M. Strange, and myself had been able to start a Big Book workshop in the same house where we tried to drink my mother to death. And the tears my mother cried that morning were tears of joy for what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous had done for her and her sons. We have met every Sunday morning continuously since that morning in 1987. This past Sunday, we had over 400 people in our meeting, in our Big Book workshop. Started with 12 and we're now over 400. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you guys for my life. Thank you for letting me share.
Thanks, Ron. It's always good to see you.
Oh my God, Ron, thank you so much. Let's give him another round of applause for sure.